I had the pleasure to get to know Bill over the last, I don't know, couple of years. And we do some service work together every Monday night, and we get a chance to hang out together and spend some time together. And a lot of good conversation, man. And Bill's dropped a lot of good knowledge on me, man, over the past, you know, few months going out to DC-4 with him. And, you know, he's a good guy, y'all. I don't know how much of this will be true, but no, I'm just kidding. Now, come on up here, Bill.
Nice turnout. Is this on? My name is Bill Stinson. I am an alcoholic. Please overlook the fact I'm wearing shades. This is not because I smoked a hooter. It's just basically the lights get at me, and I don't want to have to tear up on you guys and close my eyes and all that shit. Thanks, bros. Appreciate the support. There's a prayer that I work with my sponsees. I'd like to start with, if y'all would, just bow your head. God, I ask that you would help us to set aside what we think we know about you, about recovery, and about the spiritual path that we all walk together, so that we can see a new truth and have a new experience today. Amen. That's a good prayer. I actually was turned on to that prayer through Mark Houston, a guy that I reference a lot. He is my great-grand sponsor. If you ever want to hear some good AA, I highly recommend his speaking. He's got a lot of stuff on AA.org and stuff like that. But, you know, this is kind of about what got me here, what it was like, my experience, what happened, and what it's like now. I've always try not to do too much time qualifying myself as an alcoholic, because most people in this room know me pretty good, and I think I've done that. I've qualified myself as an alcoholic. But, you know, I started off drinking at a young age in a town that was pretty much riddled with alcoholism and drug addiction. And when I say riddled, I mean ripped apart by it. And, you know, I lost a lot of good friends. When I first started drinking, I was still in my teenage years, and I used to fool around with those models and dioramas and painting those little figures. I was very detail-oriented. And like a good alcoholic, I found out that that was a great way to make a fake ID. So that's what I did. I was about 17 at the time, almost 17. I was still 16. And I found out that I could turn a 7 into a 2. Hey! That kind of got it started. But, you know, my journey started really on the day it almost ended. The day I was born, I must have done some heinous shit in my former life, because I did not want to come here. I mean, my poor mother, God rest her soul, she was giving birth to me in a Catholic hospital with no anesthesia, and she was in labor for 26 hours. I was literally pulled from her womb, kicking and screaming. And I always, every time people say, you know, John B's old deal drags us kicking and screaming, I always think of me being born, you know. But when they finally got me here, you know, I damn near killed my mother at birth, because, you know, I was just scratching and clawing not to come out. And literally, I'm not being facetious at all. When I was born, inside of about 3 minutes, I had a severe fever that they could not break. And that lasted for the course of 10 minutes or so. At the time, the only things that they really knew to try were things like alcohol rubs and ice baths. That didn't work. I was pretty much dead. I don't know exactly how long, but my mother has always been, or always was, very much into prayer. She believed in God, and she had a strong faith, and that's where, you know, I kind of got a lot of my faith from, was from her example. And she was she was in tears. You know, I was the only child that she had ever had. She'd done buried a few husbands. So she was under the impression she couldn't even get pregnant. And along comes Bill Sr., knocks her ass up. And here I am. She actually performed somewhat of a third step, and she said, okay, God, the prayer was simple. He's yours. And she told me that when she said that prayer, just like that, the fever broke, and I was back. And that was the first miracle of my life, was coming back from a death. That was the first time I died. More on that later. But, you know, I was one of those kids that never did fit in and tried to fit in everywhere I was. I was a chameleon, like most of us. I always wanted to find my tribe, but I didn't know where they were. And, you know, alcohol come into that with a vengeance. You know, I started drinking after I made my fake ID, and we lived in a dry county. For those of you that are not familiar with a dry county, that's where everybody drinks, but nobody admits it. And that was where I lived. Small town in Mississippi. It wasn't even on the Atlas map for most of my life. Very small. And we would go either across the line into Alabama, we're right in the corner, or we'd go up to Tennessee and we would get our booze. And there was an old gentleman, he was one of my heroes. He was a bootlegger. And I love that guy, man. And his name was Alfred, and there were a lot of urban myths about Alfred. He had a liquor store and a beer store right across the line in an area where he wasn't supposed to be selling booze, and everybody knew he was there selling booze. Everybody went there to buy their booze from him. So I couldn't wait. I was all excited. I had this fake ID, so I go in there, and I drop it on the counter, and it worked. Yes, and I was off. For my first drunk, I had it all planned out. And I say for my first drunk, that was what I knew alcohol to be invented for, and that was alcohol's purpose. You don't drink that shit for flavor. You drink it for effect. And everyone I knew was alcoholic or drug addict or both, and that's just was an understood statement. It was an understood fact. When you drink alcohol, you don't stop until you are drunk. So I made a plan. I had some cash, and I went up to Alfred's, and I bought some high-level, top-shelf wine, Mad Dog 2020. And y'all may have heard of Strawberry Hill. And I got me a little Boone's Farm. You know, because I figured, you know, I planned this out pretty meticulously. I wanted to get the job done. You know, Dr. Bob said that in his story, and I understood exactly what he meant. So I figured a couple of fifths of wine and another bottle of wine, and that should do it. I didn't want to start on the hard shit because, you know, let's pace ourselves. So I drove back from Alfred's. I was about 2 miles from the house, and I figured, okay, and back in the day, they had these dumpsters where you used to take your garbage. It wasn't none of this stuff that we take for granted where they come and they pick it up for you. We had to haul our trash to a dumpster. That was also where, if you needed another dog, you could always find one. Whenever my dogs would get hit by a car, I'd go to the dumpster and get another one. I mean, they were there. And, of course, you had to be careful about that. Sometimes those bitches are in heat, and it just you don't want to get in the middle of that one. But I digress. So I'm sitting at the dumpster. It was about 2 miles from my house, and I popped open the I believe I started with the Mad Dog 2020, the bouquet. The ambiance and all of that stuff was evident. I was a cosmopolitan gentleman. I was doing it right. And I drank it, and it wasn't much for the flavor, but, man, there was a warmth that come with this liquid that was quite a sensation. And I finished that bottle, and I thought, well, now I wonder how long. See, I didn't have internet, so we couldn't Google this shit. And I'm like, okay, well, I wonder how long it's going to take for this to take effect. I don't know, I better add some to it. So I opened up the Strawberry Hill, and I took it out. And about the time I got that one finished, I'm feeling a little something. I'm like, oh, there it is. Yeah, that's the ticket. Yeah. Maybe I should start driving to the house now, just in case. So I opened the third bottle, and I started driving towards the house because I figured, you know, I didn't know. I figured when it hit me, it'd be like a thunderbolt, and I'm... and I started swigging on the last bottle on the way to the house. By the time I got to the house, I was almost done with that bottle, and I was like, yeah. And y'all know what that means. The world made sense. The people in it no longer were an agitation, even though I was by myself. I had voices in my head from the time I was able to hear anything. And, you know, it was just one of those things where I knew right then and there I had found the elixir of life. I had found the fountain of youth. I had found exactly what I needed. And I didn't realize it, but that was the beginning of my spiritual journey. And I think all of us, in my opinion, our spiritual journey doesn't necessarily start in sobriety. It starts in all the stuff that gets us to the rooms. It really does. Because if it weren't for all of those things, I wouldn't be here today. And I started drinking, and drugs were quickly behind that, a lot of drugs. And I was pretty much popular pretty quick because it got around pretty fast that, you know, I can get booze. And all my buddies were coming out of the woodwork. I didn't even know they were my friends, but they convinced me that, yeah, we've always been your friend. You're cool. Hey, can you get me, you know, and there we go. So I was working at a pizza place. I would park my car in the back. I had a trunk full of merchandise. And the guys would come in the front door, and they'd give me the money, and I'd give them the trunk key, and they'd go get their order out of the trunk. And I was a good bootlegger. I kept their shit on ice, you know, no extra charge. And they would always be happy, and they'd always come back for more. And, you know, I would even make fake IDs for some of them. Of course, they had to pay me in booze. I'll make you a fake ID, but I need a fifth of this and a six-pack of those. I figured that was fair. Already, alcohol was becoming a currency in my life. It was taking on an extreme level of importance, and I didn't even realize it. My cousin was kind of the bad boy of the family up until, you know, I started taking over the reins. But he introduced me to the drug scene, and we got started with, you know, smoking weed. I went to my first concert. It was Hall & Oates. I know, I'm embarrassed. General Public opened for Hall & Oates. Some of you kids probably never heard of neither one of them. You're not missing much. But we're going to this concert at the Von Braun Civic Center, and I'm in the back seat of his Camaro, which is this big, and we're just getting hammered. We're drinking and smoking weed, and I was off from there, you know. And then I started getting into cocaine and all these other drugs, and I found something that made me popular. I could get booze. I started going to nightclubs when I was 17 years old. I started getting involved with Patrick's was one of the bars I went to in Florence, Alabama. It's closed down now. And they used to, they really catered to alcoholics. They would have funneling contests, and I was quite good at those. They even had, when I went to college, they would have funneling contests, one college versus another. And they really did help us out with our alcoholism. God bless them. It really just helped a lot of us hit bottom, and it killed a lot of us too, unfortunately. But I got involved with the drug scene. I started making connections with getting drugs, selling drugs. And my father, I heard through my mother and other people, he was a high-level member in the Chicago Mafia. I never knew my dad. So I was like, well, you know, I need to aspire to something. So I wanted to be like him. I wanted to be a big-time drug dealer. I wanted to be a criminal. I thought that that would give me some self-worth and importance, because the ego wanted to be validated, and this was a vehicle for me to use to do that. So I got connected with every drug dealer in my hometown, and then I got connected with every drug in my town. And then I became the drug dealer in my town. And I wasn't really satisfied with just selling pills and coke and weed. I wanted to advance. So as luck would have it, a friend of mine said, well, hey, we're going to go see the Grateful Dead in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm like, well, what the fuck is that? He said, oh, man, you got to go. It's awesome. I'm like, well, do they party? He's like, dude, they party. So the show was in Atlanta, Georgia, and the camp scene was at Stone Mountain National Park, not far from Atlanta, Georgia. And man, I tell you, that was quite a sight. You got this beautiful park, and it's got this Confederate monument carved in the side of a granite wall, and you got 10,000 hippies bouncing off of the trees, doing nitrous balloons and eating acid and selling buds, and it was just incredible. Man, I loved it. I had a blast. I did that for years. And I was trying to become now not just a drug dealer, but I wanted to be a deadhead. I mean, it sounded cool. You know, I'm a deadhead. I thought I'd found my tribe. You know, I did a shitload of LSD and mushrooms. That's part of why I have light sensitivity to this day, because of all the psychedelic drugs that I imbibed. And one of those consequences that just doesn't go. But I started to get into the connections with that scene, and selling LSD in my hometown is, whoa, boy, that was a mistake. Because you've got this high-level narcotic, you're bringing it to a town of just over 2,000 people, and no one's ever heard of it, most for the most part, and you're the only connection. So I started to get what I thought I wanted, attention. I got attention from the local police. I got attention from the Mississippi Bureau of Narcotics. I got attention from the Drug Enforcement Agency. I got attention from the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Committee. I got attention. And, man, I got more than I wanted. My phones were tapped. I was tailed. I was tracked. I was paranoid as shit. You know, they say a lot of drugs will cause you to see the ninjas. I actually had ninjas following me around. It was incredible. You know, I had a dog named Guido, and he hated two things, cops and Rottweilers. And he would tangle with either one of them. And we would be at these dead shows, and he could spot the cops better than anybody I'd ever seen, or myself included. And I can still to this day spot a cop off duty. But Guido, he really could spot the cops, man. And he would bark, and the hair on his back would actually bristle up when he seen a police officer on duty, off duty, undercover, didn't matter, confidential informant, drug enforcement agent, he could spot them. So Guido, me and Guido made a good team for a long time. Of course, there was a dark side to that. He would always get into fights with Rottweilers, and I'd have to pull him off of a damn Rottweiler, and that was never fun. You know, I was trying to find my tribe, like I said, and I was trying to get involved with something that I could feel a part of. And I started, you know, with all that attention, eventually the cops started catching up, and that's what they do. I'll never forget, as a young man, I mean, it's like I'm quoting a TV show that I watched, but I was looking at 30 years in the penitentiary, and I was walking up the steps to the courthouse, and I've never known footsteps to be so heavy and hard to do as that day. To this very moment, I can still feel that stress walking up to God knows what, looking at 30 years. Well, obviously, I didn't get convicted of that. I had a good lawyer, and I avoided, you know, the big prison term, and I lost a lot of things. I come to Nashville, and my wife, her and I, at first, you know, we would drink together and we would drug together. And then it just got to where things changed, and that was after she was pregnant with our first son. And when that came along and she was pregnant, she quit, of course, doing drugs and drinking. And after Jacob was born, she didn't start back. And I guess somehow I felt like I needed to fill in the gap for her and drink a little more and do some more drugs, and I did. You know, I was more than happy to fill that void. And it just got bad. It got real bad real fast. And I would go through jobs. I'd go into a job, and then I'd try to fit in, and I couldn't do it. The drinking was taking on larger and larger proportions of my life. The drug use, it was all a mess. And it finally come to a real head at a point where I was up one night, I was drinking, I was doing coke, and I didn't know what happened until well into the event. But the next morning I got up and I was as white as a napkin, and I felt extremely weak. I thought, damn. And then I felt nauseous. I went to the restroom, and I knew I was going to throw up. When I did, blood came out. And I passed out. When I came to, I heard my baby son crying, Guido losing his shit, barking, raising hell, and my poor wife running around, and I black out. I was in and out of consciousness. When I finally came to and was able to stay conscious, I was in this white room with silver. I didn't know where I was. It was the intensive care unit at Summit Hospital. And they had this little window, and people kept coming up the window and looking in like I was a circus freak. I thought, what the hell is that all about? And finally a nurse came in. Her name was Grace, and she was from Mississippi. And I asked her, I said, what the hell's going on? Why are these people continually coming by and looking in the window at like I'm some kind of a circus freak? Am I the only guy here? She said, well, look around this room. Everything that you see that is white, that's silver, was a couple of hours ago covered in your blood. And you were dead on that table for, I guess, 7 minutes. Dead. And she said, you're not supposed to be here. And I thought, wow. You know, my drinking and my drug use had killed me physically. I'd lost every drop of blood in my body. And yet, I was brought back. So I had one of those thank you, Jesus moments. And I thought, well, that's it right there. Yeah. I'm gonna change my evil ways. I'm gonna get sober. I'm gonna quit doing drugs, and I'm gonna turn my life around. And I'm not gonna do a damn thing by myself. I made all these resolutions to whoever would listen, all these promises and solemn oaths, and it was all bullshit, every bit of it. When I got out of the intensive care unit, I was facing $33,000 in debt. I was uninsured. And, you know, we were trying to get something fixed out on that. At the time, I was in college waiting tables. I didn't make a lot of money. And I thought, well, you know, it's all going to be better now. You know, that's the final straw. I've learned what I need to know. Self-knowledge was enough to keep me sober. 3 days after I got out of the intensive care unit, I was drunk. And I was bad drunk. I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 19 because the state of Mississippi seemed to think that I had a drinking problem. I don't know where they got that, but they highly suggested that I go to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did, because I had to. And back in those days, cigarettes were still healthy. You could smoke indoors, which is very foreign today. You could actually smoke inside a building. And I would sit in these AA meetings in this basement of a church that just had a fog of nicotine. And I'm like, what the hell is this? And the meetings that I was going to at that time initially were speaker meetings. Some poor asshole like myself was up there telling his tale of woe. And I'm sitting in the back going, man, this guy's got problems. You know, I don't know. I feel for that brother. You know, and they had some, and it was mostly drunkalog stuff, and it wasn't much solution. So I didn't really get a lot out of it. But I would leave those meetings, and they had so depressed me with their drunkalog that I needed a drink. So I would get a 12-pack, and man, boy, they're sad. And I was still in the delusion. I wasn't ready. Years go by, and, you know, after that incident with the death on the table, I'm back to drinking. And, you know, it keeps coming up that this drinking is a problem. And I don't seem to have a problem, but everybody else does. Right. They've got a bad problem. They just can't seem to cope with what I know that I need to do. They didn't understand what I'm a grown-ass man. I deserve a drink every now and then. And, you know, I was pushed back into AA after another DUI. All told, I got probably 7 DUIs over the course of my drinking career. I've wrecked and totaled 3 cars. I've been in probably 6 wrecks that should have killed me. And I've been dead twice. So it dawned on me early in sobriety that there is a purpose for me to be standing exactly where I am right here today. And there's a purpose for every moment it took to get me to where I stand today. And I take that extremely seriously. And I take recovery and sobriety, I hold it sacred. I really do. I kid, I cut up, I bullshit, I talk crazy stuff, and I laugh and I play. But at the end of all of that, make no mistake, I take what we do in these rooms extremely seriously. And I can't say enough about this program, what it's done in my life. You know, I'm bouncing in and out of the rooms, and it's just not sticking. And I finally got a job working as a manager where I made more money than the wife made. Woo-hoo! Ego explodes. I had arrived, as Bill Wilson says. And I identify with that mentality that he talks about. I had arrived. I finally made more money than my wife did. And that took a long time to get there. So my drinking took on new proportions, just like Bill Wilson. I went from drinking the stuff in the middle and the bottom of the shelf to the stuff up top. I went to Maker's Mark, and that's what I drank, and I drank it every day. And I drank a lot of it. I was into pills. I took a lot of Xanax and Valium and what have you got. I kicked cocaine 6 years before I actually got sober from alcohol, but I was still smoking pot. I was still taking pills. And the insanity of my disease was I'm taking all these Xanax pills and bars and all this other, and I'm trying to map out how many I need to party for X amount of days until my drug dealer gets more so that I don't have to go through the withdrawals, which are a bitch. If you've ever kicked pills, they're a bitch. I would cramp from my earlobes to my toenails. my whole body would just knot up. I'd have to jump out of bed and stand to quell the cramping. And I never did get it right. I never got it right. I always took too much. I always took them all. And it seemed like it kept becoming a thing where the dealer man didn't get his supply when I needed it. And I wasn't even getting off on these pills. I was just taking them. I was just taking them. You know, I might have felt a tickle from the first one, but after that, I'm just trying to keep the cramps away. And the whole time, I'm swimming in booze. Well, I got pretty lit up one day, went to Panera, where I was working, and it was a portion of my drinking where I didn't know how much it took to get drunk or how much it took just to be okay enough to walk around and do what I had to do for that day. I drank the same amount I drank every day, and it knocked me on my ass. And I'm trying to go to work, and I'm hammered. And, you know, one of the other managers, he looks at me, and he says, "You're drunk as a skunk." And things went kind of black at that point. I believe, according to the police reports, I threatened to kill him. They don't really smile on that. If you're intoxicated in a public place and threatening to kill somebody, they take that pretty serious. I was fired from that job. They just couldn't take a joke. And I had lost what I thought I needed to be okay. I'd lost a job that was paying me more money than the wife was making, and I was no longer the head household breadwinner. And I'm right back to, you know, the bottom once again. I'm going through a haze at this point. I was so mad at my coworker manager that I wanted to tear up his car. He had a brand new car, and I had a great idea. I'm drunk as hell. But I had a great idea. I was going to go down to Walmart. I was going to get some kerosene, put it in his gas tank, fuck him up. I was going to really just make his whole world collapse. And I could barely walk. Y'all ever seen that movie, The Lord of the Rings, where Gollum looking for the ring?
Precious.
That was me in Walmart looking for kerosene.
Kerosene.
I was a sight. You know, to this day, I'd love to get that film footage because I know somebody somewhere is going, "What the hell was that?" I found the kerosene, but I was unable to follow through with the plan. And, you know, eventually I just said, you know what, screw it. Everything got blurry. And then I went home and I crashed. And there's a family involved with this whole thing, but I don't know what's going on with them. I don't know where they are. I don't know anything about my children. I had a daughter at the time, you know, just a baby. And I don't know anything about that family that I'm supposed to be part of because I'm in a haze. And I was trying to find a job. Bullshit. And I went to look for a job, more BS, at a bar. Which is a great idea. So I walked into this bar that I used to manage at the aquarium. I had $400 cash. And I sat down. And see, the reason I got cash was because I didn't want the wife to be able to look on my banking and see what's going on with the money. Not that she wouldn't notice I took out $400 in cash. So I've got cash and I can get away with it. I'm in the bar and I'm drinking and I'm tipping. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm drinking quite a bit. I might need to eat something. I got an appetizer, and I'm drinking, and I'm drinking, and I'm gone. And I'm looking around, and I'm in the front yard of my house. We now return to our regularly scheduled program already in progress. Yeah, you're hip. That's a blackout. It's like, what happened? There's a news break, and then you're right back in the middle of a show, and you miss something. And that's where I was. I'm in the front yard of my house in a ditch, covered in mud, and I'm screaming bloody murder. And the scream actually kind of jolted me to reality. I'm looking around. There's a cop car and a fire truck and an ambulance. I'm going, what the? Oh, shit. I just set the house on fire. And I turned and I looked at the house, and the house was fine. They were there for me. Uh-oh. Turns out I was threatening to kill a neighborhood, everybody in it, and myself as well. And they were on the phone trying to get my wife, and they said, look, if you can't come here and get him, see, I was the thing that had to be come and got. I was the thing that had to be claimed. We're going to have to take him. And she was off doing family stuff with the kids in Murfreesboro. I don't know what they're doing. I'm not a part of anything. I'm just drunk. I'm walking around in a blind haze. So they took me to the nervous hospital. Fine establishment. And the nervous hospital was awesome. I had a 3-day stretch at this institution. And they gave me Valium, which I really enjoyed. And I was, believe it or not, I was never late for MedPass. I was probably the first one in line. Yep, right there. And I wanted to impress these folks at how I was going to get and stay sober. And I was telling them all my grand plans and ideas. And they would smile and nod. And I don't know what they were thinking, but it wasn't positive. They weren't really on my cheerleading squad. So I was kept in there for 3 days, and I remember there was a gentleman that would come out, and he was bringing AA meetings, and he would say things like, you're not bad people trying to be good. You're sick people trying to get well. That resonated with me because I'd been a bad person for so long. I'd never had anybody from the heart tell me something like you're a good person, you're sick. And I'd been to meetings, I'd been in and out. I'd heard a lot of the solution. When I got to Nashville, I really was saturated with a bunch of good recovery. But if a person's not ready to hear, then they can't hear. And I wasn't ready for a long time. And I was let go from that institution after 3 days. Somehow I thought that I was going to get a welcome home. I was envisioning stuff like that back there on the wall. Welcome home, Dad. We're so glad you're okay. No. They looked at me like I owed every one of them large sums of money. And I was not paying my interest, and they were mad. They didn't want me in that house, and it was obvious. So I'm bouncing in and out of the rooms. I'm going to meetings and getting drunk after meetings. I'm trying to do it all by myself. And I was about to go to the noon Shade Tree meeting one day, and I said to hell with it. I went and got drunk instead. And, you know, I got on a tear of a drunk, and it was bad. They took me down. You know, before they put me in the nervous hospital, they took my blood to see how drunk I was. And people were lined up to say, where's the body? They said, oh, Bill's sitting right over there. He's joking with the nurses. I had like a 3.98. I had a little bit of blood in my alcohol. I should have been dead. I was conscious. And they said, Bill, we think you might have a drinking problem. I said, no, I do. I'm out. I need more. And so I've had death as an experience and a consequence of my drinking and drugging. I've had institutions. My last drunk, I made threats to the family to kill them. So it's off to jail. And when I got to jail, that was it. I'd lost my job. Now, this was all in very fast succession. I lost my job, lost my income, I lost my identity, I lost my home, I lost my family. They had they had an order of protection on me. And I couldn't go near my kids for 10 months. Couldn't communicate with my family. I was homeless. And I was in jail. And there was nothing left. I used to have visions before I'd conk out in the cell of all of those things that I thought were important just being swept away, because that was what was happening. I'd lost it all. We say we lose things, but in retrospect, I gave it all to alcohol, every bit of it. I started seeing people in jail bringing meetings in. I'd been to a lot of meetings around here before. I'd been to a lot of meetings in my past, and it was starting to dawn on me that you guys in these rooms had something that I desperately wanted. And the first miracle for me was, you know, it's really hard to peg the very first miracle, but some of the first miracles for me were starting to realize that I couldn't do it by myself or I was gonna die. And another miracle in my experience was I actually gave a damn if I was gonna die or not. Because for a long time I didn't want to live. So a miracle can be many things. I had a desire to live, and that was God stepping in. I had a desire for sobriety, because I would think while I was in jail about all the faces I saw that I used to think were so full of shit, so foreign, so they got to be faking it, whatever. But they were happy. They had a purpose. They had a light. They had God in their life. They had serenity, something I didn't even know. They had a purpose, something I never knew, something I seeked but never knew what I was looking for. I was looking for God my whole life, and I couldn't find him in booze or drugs or dealing or money, none of that. But I knew there was something in here that I had to get. So they brought the meetings to jail. And just like MedPass at the Nervous Hospital, I was first in line for the AA meetings in jail. That's where I met Gary Eubanks. Gary remains a great friend of mine. And he was bringing meetings in there with some other people. And I had a lot of God shots and God moments in jail. And there were a lot of miracles, you know. God provided for me exactly what I needed when I needed it. I would get things like paper to write on, do journaling. I've still got a jail journal of 80 pages wrapped up with a rubber band. I hadn't even looked at it in over 5 years. You know, I would get a pen, which was a miracle. I would see people in jail that would tell me stories of how they got sober or how they tried to get sober. And then I had the meetings. I wasn't supposed to be able to get a big book. I got a big book. I wasn't supposed to be able to get a Bible, and I got a Bible. I mean, miracle after miracle after miracle. Small, but huge. And I would tell anybody that would sit still for 2 minutes when I get out of here, if it hair lips hell, no matter what I have to do, I will get and stay sober, so help me God. And they laughed. And I'm so glad they did. Because they pissed me off. They did. And I stayed sober at them sons of bitches. And I stand here today, still sober. Still sober. By the grace of God and a little work on my part. Sobriety has been the most extraordinary part of my life. As a matter of fact, I think that's where my life truly began, was when I got beat up and broken into enough to surrender and get into this program full bore. I've got a great sponsor. I've had him for over 5 years. I love him like a brother. As a matter of fact, better than a brother. You know, I've sponsored guys. I go to drug court. I've been pleased and very honored to be a part of drug court for over 5 years, going out there and helping these convicts, calling them on their bullshit, just like I used to have to be called on mine when I was incarcerated. I see the light come on in their eyes, not all of them, but just one or two every now and then is enough to keep me going and keep me encouraged to do it. This is a fellowship of a spiritual nature beyond anything that can be described. You know, there's no way to put into words the experiences that I've had in recovery. The spiritual moments, the enlightening moments, the epiphanies, the God shots, God wakes, whatever the hell you want to call it. I get them every day. I get them every day. This is not a boring thing. I was mad at God when I got here. I was pissed off. And today I'm a fan of God. You know, I was not only missing God, I was missing the power behind the name. That's what I had to have. Screw the name. I needed the power. Lack of power, that was my dilemma. And when I started to see the benefits of doing simple things like my sponsor telling me to read page 86 every day and do what it says, meditation, prayer, all these simple things that I do on a daily basis have given me what the book says and I know to be true in experience, an unshakable foundation that I continue to build a spiritual structure on that has no limits. I have a creator today that only has the limits that my mind tries to impose upon it. And I have an awareness to know when that ego, that little son of a bitch, is trying to come along and throw me to the wayside. He don't go away. He keeps coming back. I think I'll keep coming back too. Thank you, everyone.